Hi, you are tuned to the Channel of Truth, Truth News Radio Australia, on the 7th of March 2015. It's a great pleasure to be with you today, folks. And today I'm going to be bringing you some research. I'm going to be covering a few topics which kind of interlink. And unfortunately, I don't have any guests lined up for the second hour, so this is going to be a one-hour show. I've been traveling a bit lately, and I've recently just returned to Australia after being overseas for some time, and a little bit unsettled at the moment. I'm hoping to get back into a good routine of interviews, and got a lot of very important people I want to get on this show. But for now, I'm going to bring you today some thoughts and reflections on kind of two parallel themes. Very familiar to our listeners, but I want to bring some new data into that. I want to talk about the perennial problem of the nanny state, the endless encroaching increase in powers that are being transferred to government to basically allow them to manage your life in all kinds of ways. I mean, it really is across the board. It's not just in the area of national security. It's also in the area of the opening hours of liquor stores. It's also in the way the tax department operates. There are, you know, in every sphere, we have the noose growing tighter. But of course, that's all done with the very strong belief of all those involved, that this is for the good, for the greater good, that it is indeed necessary and wonderful that they're doing these things. And many, many people will certainly go along with that, because in the individual cases, I mean, let's talk about liquor laws in Australia, particularly in New South Wales, where I live. It's believed that there is a terrible problem with alcohol-fueled violence, and that the only way to deal with that is through legal measures. And the legal measures have been brought in successively, just basically limiting what venues can do, forcing them to close at certain times, but also bringing in certain bizarre regulations that are really counterintuitive and sort of defy the whole concept of what a restaurant or a bar is. Sort of turns it into an institution which operates according to the statutes, you know, of the nanny state. I mean, just to give you an example, they've brought in what they call lockout laws, and the lockout laws were specifically brought in for one region in Sydney, King's Cross, which is one of the sort of notorious red light districts of Sydney, but also a place that has many bars and restaurants. Now, the idea behind the lockout law is that you will effectively close an establishment at a certain time, but people can stay inside. They can leave, but they can't come back in. And on the face of it, some people might say, well, that sounds fine. You know, I mean, but you can stay there, you just can't come in. But like every overarching authoritarian rule, it has really unwanted consequences on people. And for example, I had a friend who told me he was in a pub with some equipment, and you know, he needed to actually get a cab, and he needed to go out the door or hail a cab and go back in and grab his music equipment and put it in the cab. Well, they wouldn't let him back in, like, once he'd gone out the door, and he told them what he wanted to do. But this is what actually happens. See, this is the idiocy and the stupidity of these types of laws, which are designed to deal with a particular situation, but then they just end up being incredibly inconvenient to people who are completely innocent of any of those types of charges. I mean, it's a trivial example, but you know what we've seen also in New South Wales is uniform laws about purchase of takeaway alcohol. Every single liquor store in New South Wales must close at 10 p.m. and cannot sell alcohol to takeaway after 10 p.m. Doesn't matter what day of the week, on a Saturday night. And I experienced this recently when I bought a pizza with a friend. We were having it at home, and I thought, oh, we'll just go out and get a bottle of wine. It was 1 minute past 10. No chance. the whole state couldn't get a bottle of wine after 10 p.m. You could go into a bar and drink it. You just couldn't buy it and take it home. And this is unacceptable, folks, in a free society. And I had a big lecture with the guy behind the bar and in the pub that I went into, and I said, look, mate, this is really ridiculous, you know. I mean, I want to take a bottle of wine home. And he said, well, that's the law. And I said, well, you know what? You should quit your job. You shouldn't be putting up with this because, you know, we as customers, this is a consumer society, right? A capitalist society, which you're a business, I'm a consumer, and you're limiting what I can do according to some idiotic government statute. And, you know, you shouldn't put up with it. I shouldn't, and neither should you. You know, he was a bit shocked at what I said. But folks, you know, really, if you're in that industry, you should be protesting. It's hurting the economy. It's unacceptable. And people should not simply, as they do in Australia, so many people simply say, oh, well, you know, we'll go a bit earlier and buy our wine. No, you should make a very big protest. If 100 people made a big fuss over it, even in one day, it would have an impact. Imagine if 1,000 people did. But the big problem, folks, the big problem that we've got with this drift to totalitarianism is that everyone simply goes along to get along. I know everyone's busy, everyone's got a job, everyone's paying off a mortgage, and the last thing we want to do is cause a fuss at the liquor store when we want to buy a bottle of alcohol at 10:01 p.m. But you know what? That's what you got to do. If you want freedom and democracy, you're going to have to make a fuss over things as stupid as that. Anyway, I'll leave that with you. There's far more important things to talk about today. And I'm going to cover some news. I'm also going to bring you an essay by John Pilger, which cuts right into the question of the rise of fascism. And I'm going to juxtapose that with this question of dishonesty, this question of how totalitarianism and dishonesty of government are very, very common bedfellows. They go together like a horse and carriage. Where there is authoritarianism, there will be massive dishonesty. And you know what? The worse the authoritarianism gets, the worse will be the dishonesty. And I think as people begin to realize that, that's when they realize, oh dear, you know, we really do have to do something about this. We really are going to have to make some sacrifices. We might have to take a bullet at some point, you know, to stop this. So look, let's begin by talking about recent national security legislation. And I want to start with some laws that were actually brought in last year. The National Security Amendment Bill of 2014. And this gave Australia's ASIO, which is the equivalent of the CIA or MI5 in the UK, gave ASIO the power to monitor the entire Australian internet with just one warrant. And it also brought in new laws which led to journalists and whistleblowers facing up to 10 years jail for disclosing classified information. And the definition of what is classified information is incredibly loosely controlled, because any ASIO operation can be declared special by an authorised ASIO officer, and therefore any disclosure of that operation therefore becomes an offence. I mean, this is effectively a complete shutdown of journalistic rights, of whistleblowers, and, you know, we let the horse out of the stable on that one, folks. You know, that's gone. That law has been passed. It went through on the 1st of October 2014. Now, let's just hear a little about it. This is from a news report from late in 2014. That's on Fairfax. Terror laws clear Senate, enabling entire Australian web to be monitored and whistleblowers to be jailed. Here we go.
The most important reform of the powers of our national security agency since the 1979 ASIO Act
Australian authorities will have far greater powers to monitor the internet if new anti-terrorism laws, which cleared the Senate on Thursday night, are passed by the House of Representatives next week.
44 ayes and a 12 noes, the matter is resolved in the affirmative.
The National Security Legislation Amendment Bill allows ASIO to seek just one warrant to access a limitless number of computers on a computer network when attempting to monitor a target. Lawyers and academics have warned that this would effectively allow the entire internet to be monitored, as the internet is a network of networks, and the bill does not specifically define what constitutes a computer network. The new laws also state that anyone who recklessly discloses information that relates to a special intelligence operation faces up to 10 years in jail. That includes whistleblowers, journalists, and bloggers. Any operation can be declared special, and doing so gives ASIO criminal and civil immunity. Some lawyers and academics say they fear the agency will abuse this power. On Thursday night, the laws passed the Senate with bipartisan support from Labor.
What we have achieved tonight is to ensure that those who protect us, particularly in a newly dangerous age, have the strong powers and capabilities they need. But we've also achieved the outcome that those strong powers are protected by and balanced by strong safeguards.
The Greens opposed the bill, and earlier this week, Senator Scott Ludlam explained why he was concerned.
The idea that journalists or somebody sharing an item on Facebook could be prosecuted and jailed for 10 years for disclosing information in the public interest. The idea that ASIO's definition of a computer network effectively could encompass the entire internet. I've got very, very grave misgivings both about the way that this has been done and the measures that are in the bill.
I'll just leave it there and just note that the Greens always oppose these types of measures, but they do so in a completely ineffective way, which never has any real impact. Occasionally they introduce small amendments, small changes, but the government of the day always gets through what they want. And the Greens kind of serve as a weak, toothless kind of representation of the people's rights and democracy. And meanwhile, the Greens are harnessed to bring in other nanny state measures like carbon taxes, and they do so with full vigour, which actually makes their whole position so compromised in that it's really not, they have no clear position on the basic principles of freedom and rights. They have a very confused and muddied and muddled concept of what is right and what is wrong and what is intrinsic to human freedom. So let's just move on now to some more recent developments. And we are going to break, but when we come back from the break, I'm going to read you an article from crikey.com, which talks a little about mandatory data retention, which is the next thing that we have to look forward to in our wonderful nanny state. So you're with Truth News, Radio Australia, talking about some of our core issues here on the show, and I'll be back after this short break. Don't go away. Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio. And just talking about some recent national security legislation in Australia. And I just wanted to add as an addendum to the National Security Amendment Bill, from the Attorney General's office. They've said here on the government page that the reforms implemented by this bill will make a lasting and important contribution to the future capability of our intelligence agencies and will ensure that they are able to continue to protect Australia and Australians from those who would do us harm. Now, just note the language there. It's very important. This idea of being protected is an incredibly powerful one which reaches out to a lot of people, and people do feel They feel warmed by it. They feel it is a good thing. Well, they're trying to protect us. But they're creating an us and them scenario. And you probably think, well, you know, I'm not in the them group. I'm in the us group, right? Well, think again, folks. You know, you may be a law-abiding citizen who's never done anything wrong. You may pay your taxes. You may not be a terrorist. You may do everything according to the letter of the law. But you are still not necessarily us. You could be them. Because the way these types of things are implemented is everyone is a potential suspect. I mean, the way surveillance is applied, the way ASIO's powers are applied, generally with terrorism, they're finding what they call clean skins, people who have no background in terrorism. All the major suicide bombings have been that type of thing. So you know, Mr. Joe Normal goes to work every day, catches the bus, does everything right. You could be the next suspect in an investigation. I'm just saying, you know, it's not really us and them. It's everyone's them. The us is just the government, right? The us is the government and its lackeys and the people who are on the inside who have power. And the rest of the whole population is potentially the enemy. And this is what we need to convey when we're trying to explain to people why we've got a problem here, is this is the type of scenario that has been created. It's also just the classic scenario of authoritarianism and totalitarianism. It's just being brought in very slowly and very nicely with very lovely wording and trying to make people feel good as they bring it all in. Now, recently, Australia's Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, has made some statements about what they call the balance between individual rights and government power. And there's an article here from the ABC, and it's all about the Sydney Lindt Cafe siege. As Australian listeners will no doubt remember, the great, terrible, shocking terrorist event of our decade, where one man, allegedly with a sawn-off shotgun, held some people hostage. And then at the end of the day, the police burst in and killed a few people without even attempting to negotiate with a man who was clearly mentally unbalanced. But because he asked for an ISIS flag, it turned into a terrorism event, when really it was just a case of a man who had domestic violence issues kind of just losing it. And it's the sort of thing that happens actually all the time. It's happening all over the place every day. It's a type of continuum as domestic violence. Although in this case, it wasn't exactly domestic violence, but the man did have a history of that. But anyway, the long and short of it is that Prime Minister Tony Abbott has foreshadowed changing the balance between community protection and personal freedoms. Yes, folks. And one of the things he said, we need to ask ourselves at what stage do we need to change the tipping point from protection of the individual to the safety of the community? See, again, this is being set up for you to think, well, safety of the community, I'm part of the community, right? I want to feel safe. So some individuals, maybe the guy across the road, maybe some guy with dark skin, you know, if I've got white skin, maybe it's just going to be some foreigner that's going to have to maybe suffer some inconvenience. No, it's going to be everyone. Everyone. You are the individual too. You are not the community. No individual is the community. The community is an abstract concept. It's an abstract concept which is actually used to manipulate you, the individual, to go along with what the government wants to do. It's part of the greater good argument. It's for the good of the community. So let's have a look here at an article from crikey.com. Now, one of the measures that has been proposed, in addition to all the other measures, is increasing data retention laws. And we've seen that in many countries. And it's coming to Australia too, folks. And I've got an article here, data retention will hurt you, not criminals. Here's how. The government's data retention is far more likely to harm ordinary Australians than catch criminals or terrorists. Bernard Keane and senior IP communications lawyer Leanne Donnell explain how. Debate over a data retention scheme can seem abstruse, given the technical aspects of the debate and the complex legal and philosophical issues around freedom of speech, a free press, and privacy. The Prime Minister is demanding that a mandatory data retention scheme be rushed through Parliament with little debate and less information. There is no settled definition of what data is to be retained, and the telephone and ISP companies that will be forced to implement the scheme don't know the costs they will face. Tony Abbott claims it is a national security priority, but in fact there is nothing in the bill that will limit the use of data retention to terrorism or even the most serious crimes. The Australian Federal Police have even said it will be used to investigate people who download movies. But the scheme will have direct impacts on all Australians. It will increase the cost of internet access as companies pass on the costs of the scheme, expected to be in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and call it a surveillance tax. Call it a surveillance tax. I mean, you'll be paying for your own government to collect data on you. Smaller ISPs will have to meet the costs of the scheme while competing against larger companies, likely reducing the competition in that industry. See, another outcome of these types of measures is they eliminate the free market. They force every business to coalesce into some giant mega corporation. And guess what? The mega corporation is closely partnered with the government and will really allow complete access to all information. It's much harder when you've got lots of smaller companies, particularly in the internet area where you've got ISPs that hold all this data separately. Oh, how awkward and inconvenient for the government to have to get that information one by one. But one of the consequences of the laws they bring in is to crush all the smaller businesses. That's the beautiful coalescence, convergence of brutal totalitarian methods. That they everything points in the same direction. All roads lead to Rome. So this will be a disincentive for companies to invest in communications infrastructure, placing our economy at a competitive disadvantage. And yes, that's another effect. The economy is going to be dragged down too, which of course will give the government more power as Social Security and monetary stimulus measures basically increase the role of government in society. Again, another classic sign of descent into tyranny. Now, some additional bullet points here from the Crikey.com article. Data retention will affect Australians in ways the government has preferred not to discuss. The following are a series of scenarios that could plausibly occur under an Australian data retention scheme. Indeed, many of them are based on incidents that have occurred in other countries in recent years. A Sydney grandmother receives a demand for $10,000 from an American copyright troll law firm, which threatens to sue her unless she pays. Using a preliminary discovery application directed to her Australian ISP, the firm obtained her contact details associated with the IP address detected as having downloaded a movie, which her visiting grandson obtained via a file-sharing site. A media company engaged in phone hacking and bribery of public officials hires a private detective to compile a dossier on a lawyer representing many of its victims. We are going to break. I'll continue with that. Some very interesting bullet points here showing the way in which these laws about protection are really about persecution. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. Hi, you're with Truth News Radio Australia, and I'm Herewood Fenton. Great pleasure to be with you today, folks. And if you're listening and you want to support what we do, I would be delighted if you would do so by going to the website and becoming a subscriber. It would certainly help me out. And I've got some pretty difficult issues I'm trying to deal with at the moment just to keep this show going. And I'm going to be a little busy over the next few months because I'm going to be working full-time as an IT professional, which is the other thing I do for a living, while I continue to maintain this show. I've had a bit of latitude to have more time on the show in the last year or two. I've sort of sacrificed some of my personal income in order to be able to do the show, but unfortunately I simply can't do that anymore, which is going to have a detrimental impact on the show, and I do apologize to subscribers for that. There is absolutely nothing I can do about it. I've tried to get the number of subscribers of the show up, but it simply hasn't happened, and I've been forced to basically shackle myself into the wage slave industry, and I will be doing it tough, as they say, but I will not give up on this show. I will continue, and I do believe somewhere down the track things will pick up. But look, I just want to continue now with the article from Crikey. And what they're doing is they're outlining here the way in which the security legislation in regard to data retention can backfire. And this is in ways that's probably not even intended. It's not deliberate, but there's this convergence of effects from tyranny, which is, it's almost mystical. It's almost, you've got to look deep into the spiritual aspect of what goes on here. When society turns bad, when it turns in on itself, there are a cascading series of consequences, which are all inevitable, but which can seem a little bit disconnected from each other. But one of those consequences is an increase in pure criminality, which is ironic, considering what they're trying to do is eliminate criminality, but it actually increases it. And it increases it in ways which are more devious and potentially far more devastating to people. Now, just moving with the second bullet point on the effect of the data retention and the creation of a kind of a repository of information which can be accessed by those who are given the keys to the kingdom, as it were, the ability to get in there for whatever reason, could be associated with corporate interests or purely law enforcement. A media company engaged in phone hacking and bribery of public officials hires a private detective to compile a dossier on the lawyer representing many of its victims. The detective bribes a police officer to secure the metadata of the lawyer, and a check of her phone call records shows she has recently contacted an abortion clinic. The company is in a position to threaten to reveal the information unless she abandons litigation. Now, let me just unpack that for you. What's actually going on here? And this is proven to happen. It's the news of the day in the UK. A Murdoch-owned publication was routinely involved in collaboration with the police and hacking of phone accounts. This would be slightly different in that they would collaborate with the police to get some information from the police, but then, you know, the way the tabloid media works is they might offer the police a little something. You know, you give me a little something, I give you a little something. You know, you access the computer there to get me a little metadata on this person, and we'll give you some other information that might help you in one of your investigations. This is the way it works, and it's all rich and powerful. It's the government and the corporations working together to secure total power. Corporatism, as it's often called. I'll just read you one more bullet point. There's a lot here, and I'll refer you to the article on the show notes of today's show. A wealthy US-based religious cult is accused of keeping its members in virtual slavery by an Australian politician. The cult sues the politician making these claims and uses the litigation to subpoena his telephone records, thereby identifying the cult members who have contacted him to provide him with the information. they are ostracized, sued, and harassed by the cult. I mean, that's perhaps an outlier type case, but it actually shows you how devious and determined people can exploit these types of provisions for reasons that really have nothing to do with anything good, anything that would protect people. It's actually about hurting people. So, wow, I mean, we're faced with a scenario that George Orwell knew only too well. And I'm going to read to you a little essay from George Orwell, but before that I want to read to you an essay by John Pilger, which is titled Why the Rise of Fascism is Again the Issue. Now, the main thrust of this article, folks, is it's about the pure aggressive military strategy and the dishonesty engaged in by major Western governments. But you need to keep that in mind when you hear them talking about how they're trying to protect you and how every law they bring in is for the greater good and we're only just trying to get the bad people and we want to help you, we want to protect you. And then you realize, as you look at the geopolitics and you look at what's happening around the globe, well, they're just lying all the time. They're engaging in military aggression for interests of pure power and empire. So how can you trust anything they say about trying to protect you? So here we go from John Pilger, article published on the 26th of February 2015. And I'll only read a snippet of this. It's quite a long article, but very well worth reading. The recent 70th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz was a reminder of the great crime of fascism, whose Nazi iconography is embedded in our consciousness. Fascism is preserved as history, as flickering footage of goose-stepping black shirts, their criminality terrible and clear. Yet in the same liberal societies whose war-making elites urge us never to forget, the accelerating danger of a modern kind of fascism is suppressed, for it is their fascism. To initiate a war of aggression, said the Nuremberg Tribunal judges in 1946, is not only an international crime, it is the supreme international crime, differing only from other war crimes in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole. Had the Nazis not invaded Europe, Auschwitz and the Holocaust would not have happened. Had the United States and its satellites not initiated their war of aggression in Iraq in 2003, almost a million people would be alive today. An Islamic State or ISIS would not have us in thrall to its savagery. They are the progeny of modern fascism, weaned by the bombs, bloodbaths and lies that are the surreal theatre known as news. Unlike the fascism of the 1930s and 1940s, big lies are delivered with the precision of a metronome, thanks to an omnipresent repetitive media and its virulent censorship by omission. Take the catastrophe in Libya. In 2011, NATO launched 9,700 strike sorties against Libya, of which more than a third were aimed at civilian targets. Uranium warheads were used. The cities of Misurata and Sirte were carpet bombed. The Red Cross identified mass graves, and UNICEF reported that most of the children killed were under the age of 10. The public sodomizing of the Libyan president, Muammar Gaddafi, with a rebel bayonet was greeted by the then US Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, with the words, "We came, we saw, he died." His murder, like the destruction of his country, was justified with a familiar big lie. He was planning genocide against his own people. "We knew that if we waited one more day," said Obama, "Benghazi could suffer a massacre that would have reverberated across the region and strained the conscience of the world." We're going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. And we'll be back with more of this topic and more detail and more essays coming up. Don't go away.
Happens in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it?
Hi, welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio. And I'm just reading to you an article here by John Pilger. And he's talking really about the resurgence of fascism, its new face, something I've talked about a lot, and I've done some little video presentations on it, actually, which I might link on this show. I did it a few years ago. Trying to illustrate the fact that what we are seeing now in the Western world is the rise of fascism again, with a different disguise. You know, old wine in a new bottle, but the new bottle is quite different to the old. But you know, the wine is very, very similar, folks. Now, he was talking here about the Libyan war, which of course resulted in massive human casualties of children. And just skipping through the article here, the humanitarian war against Libya drew on a model close to Western liberal hearts, especially in the media. In 1999, Bill Clinton and Tony Blair sent NATO to bomb Serbia because they lied. The Serbians were committing genocide against ethnic Albanians in the secessionist province of Kosovo. And the U.S. ambassador for war crimes, David Sheffer, claimed that as many as 225,000 ethnic Albanian men might have been murdered. And again, you know, none of these claims were ever substantiated. But now, of course, we've moved to a new phase where the West is now demonizing Russia, and particularly the Russian president, in a way that is incredibly crude and incredibly confrontational. But this, again, has parallels with fascism of the past, and John Pilger has highlighted that in his article. In 1946, the Nuremberg Tribunal prosecutor said of the German media, "The use made by Nazi conspirators of psychological warfare is well known. Before each major aggression, with some few exceptions based on expediency, they initiated a press campaign calculated to weaken their victims and to prepare the German people psychologically for the attack. In the propaganda system of the Hitler state, it was the daily press and the radio that were the most important weapons." In The Guardian on February 2 of this year, Timothy Garton Ash called in effect for a world war. "Putin must be stopped," said the headline. "And sometimes only guns can stop guns." He conceded that the threat of war might nourish a Russian paranoia of encirclement, but that was fine. He name-checked the military equipment needed for the job and advised his readers that America has the best kit. In 2003, Garton Ash, an Oxford professor, repeated the propaganda that led to the slaughter in Iraq. "Saddam Hussein," he wrote, "has, as Colin Powell documented, stockpiled large quantities of horrifying chemical and biological weapons and is hiding what remains of them. He is still trying to get nuclear ones." So this, you know, this use of the press to demonize a foreign leader is a precursor to war. It's also incredibly dishonest. It just has so many things in it which are absolutely in line with fascism of the past that really we can't afford to ignore it anymore. And let me just finish up today by reading to you a little from George Orwell. The experiences of George Orwell in the Spanish Civil War were, of course, very important in formulating his ideas and when he went to write 1984. the way in which history is rewritten, the way in which the powers that be use the media, or as he called it in 1984, the Ministry of Truth, to condition people to accept virtually any type of extreme aggression on the part of the government, military invasions, and of course crackdowns within the society. So I'm just reading to you a short clip here from the essay by George Orwell, which is titled Looking Back on the Spanish Civil War. I have little direct evidence about the atrocities in the Spanish Civil War. I know that some were committed by the Republicans, and far more by the fascists. But what impressed me then, and has impressed me ever since, is that atrocities are believed in or disbelieved solely on the grounds of political predilection. Everyone believes in the atrocities of the enemy and disbelieves in those of his own side, without ever bothering to examine the evidence. Recently, I drew up a table of atrocities during the period between 1918 and the present. There was never a year when atrocities were not occurring somewhere or other, and there was hardly a single case when the left and the right believed in the same stories simultaneously. And stranger yet, at any moment, the situation can suddenly reverse itself, and yesterday's proved to be atrocity story can become a ridiculous lie, merely because the political landscape has changed. But unfortunately, the truth about atrocities is far worse than that they are lied about and made into propaganda. The truth is that they happen. The fact, often addressed as a reason for scepticism, that the same horror stories come up in war after war, merely makes it rather more likely that these stories are true. Evidently, they are widespread fantasies, and war provides an opportunity for putting them into practice. And this is a very important point to consider, because I know many people these days believe that some events are completely staged. Many people are saying that the ISIS executions are staged. You know what? There's probably some staging going on, but I tell you what, there's a lot of atrocities going on as well. And one of the dangers of trying to be a revisionist, trying to understand history, is that you get into this revisionist mindset, which actually is being manipulated by people along the sidelines. And there are many people, for example, in the World War II revisionist camp, who try to whitewash the entire Nazi regime. And again, this is just another example of you being manipulated. And just relevant to that, what George Orwell goes on to say here. And he's talking here about the World War II in general. And this essay was written, I think, during the Second World War. There is not the slightest doubt, for instance, about the behavior of the Japanese in China, nor is there much doubt about the long tail of fascist outrages during the last 10 years in Europe. The volume of testimony is enormous, and a respectable proportion of it comes from the German press and radio. These things really happened, and that is the thing to keep one's eye on. They happened even though Lord Halifax said it happened. The raping and butchering in Chinese cities, the torturing in the cellars of the Gestapo, the elderly Jewish professors flung into cesspools, and the machine gunning of refugees along the Spanish roads, they all happened. And they did not happen any the less because the Daily Telegraph has suddenly found out about them when it is 5 years too late. And that's incredibly relevant to the current situation, where we are being inundated with stories of atrocities. And there are claims by some that the atrocities didn't occur. For example, with the Syrian gas attacks that were attributed to the Syrian government in 2013, there were some who were claiming, well, this never happened. There were some claiming that it was all staged. With some of our recent terrorist events, even things like the Sandy Hook shooting in the United States, people have said, oh, well, this didn't happen, it was all done with crisis actors. I think it can be tempting to fall into that sort of view of things, because it is really hard to wrap your mind around the fact that there are people out there who are so inhuman, are so dehumanized that they will actually engage in the most grotesque atrocities. But I do believe that that is the reality, folks, is that there are many, many people out there, and many of them are tied to regimes. Many of them are brainwashed members of cults or regimes. In many cases, they are just flipped out members of our own society, sometimes people who return from a military tour of duty, or people who just have that psychopathic twist in their nature and commit the most ghastly atrocities. And another case in point, of course, where the two sides of this equation never seem to come together, would be the downing of that Malaysian Airlines flight in the Ukraine. And we still don't really have closure on that. But of course, that event was used with incredible effectiveness to demonize the Russians. And you know what? I don't know the truth. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if it was perhaps Russian separatists who accidentally downed it. It's very unlikely it would have been a deliberate act, because it would have had no military objective for them and merely made the Russian separatists look bad. But because of the deviousness of the way these types of events are orchestrated, it could have been that it was set up to make that happen by changing the flight path of that aircraft so that it would be mistaken for a military transport train, and then knowing that they would shoot it down. You know, anything's possible. But the main point to realize, the main thing to keep your eye on, is the fact that this manipulation of information is just so intrinsic, it's so deep, that every shred of information that comes from reporting from crisis zones, from areas of conflict in the world, is going to be subject to the same usage. But I do encourage you to have a look at that essay by John Pilger. And I'll also link the one by George Orwell. It's quite a long, detailed essay. The one by Pilger really focuses on the demonization of Russia and why this is something we must be very concerned about. And then relate that back to the nanny state that you live in, where they're constantly telling you how everything they're doing is to protect you. So that's our show for this week, folks. I hope you found it useful. I will be back next week, and I'll be trying to line up some great guests for the show for the entire year. So, signing out from Truth News Radio Australia, I'll be talking to you again very soon. Cheers.